This is episode 199 of Sertar Podcast. Within that, we reached episode 4 in our mini-series called COVID Conversations. I produced this in collaboration with British Council Hungary, and the goal of these interviews is to get a deeper understanding of the current pandemic situation by talking with leading experts and scientists in the field, both from Hungary and from the United Kingdom. I have to say a big thank you to my Patreon supporters who made these nearly 200 episodes possible, so big thank you to my Patreon supporters. And also special thanks to the Embassy of the United Kingdom here in Budapest, who are the main sponsors of COVID Conversation. This episode will be in English, as you might have noticed, because my guest tonight is the director of the Vaccine Center at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. And as you might have guessed, we will be talking about vaccines tonight. If you have any questions, feel free to ask in the comment section. And please welcome Beate Kampmann. Jó estét kívánok!
Jó estét kívánok! Nem beszélek magyarul, which is why we have to do this in English. I'm sorry.
You know, you surprised me when we made this technical run through and you greeted me with this perfect, nearly flawless Hungarian. Okay, I really appreciate that. Well, I'm not sure if you have seen the post of British Council on Facebook about this event.
I don't think so. No.
So you probably haven't noticed the comments, what we got under this announcement.
There was quite a bit of writing in Hungarian, and there was one person who wrote pathetic, but I decided to ignore that and not to put all the Hungarian stuff into Google Translate. So off you go. Tell me what they said.
Actually, those comments were rather polarized, I would say. Some people were fascinated by the fact that we will be talking about this issue tonight. And some other people were quoting different disinformation materials and how fake this is, and vaccine researchers are just sponsored by, I guess, you know, all these conspiration theories.
I guess
theories.
That's why we're chatting, right? Because we can maybe set some of these facts right. And, you know, the world will always fall into extremes, and hopefully we'll can give some reasonable information that people can relate to. And you know, there's a chat box there, people can put their questions, and I'm not saying I have the answer to all the questions, but I can at least help people think them through.
Yeah, we can also, or you can also check useful links down in the video description that Beate already sent me, so you can find all this information and maybe it helps you navigate within these questions. But can you tell me what you felt or what you did in January or February earlier this year?
Well, actually, I was doing a session for the British Council in Valencia on the question of giving vaccines to women in pregnancy, which is another fairly controversial topic. And there were people in the audience who said, so what about, you know, the COVID situation had just started to rise in China. And there were a few cases in Italy, et cetera. And people were saying, you know, what about it? And to be perfectly honest, I didn't quite see the scale of it at that point. You know, it became very obvious the moment things started to come a little closer to home. We tend to have slight blind spots when it comes to places very far away. But it just shows that infectious diseases don't know any borders and viruses don't have passports, and they just came across. And then as an infectious diseases specialist, it became, you know, a mixture of being very excited about a totally new disease, as we do get as scientists and also clinicians, and also getting very, you know, scared and thinking, okay, this is actually massive, before it even started to impinge on work that I was doing personally. But that happened very quickly then. So yeah, it was a bit of a roller coaster.
When you said it was very quick, can you recall what time frame we could talk about? Like when you got the first news, when did you first notice that, okay, this is a major scale and we have to tackle this issue?
Yeah, right. So, you know, we had some news or some hints that there's something was going on really through websites in late December, early January. And then came February, it was absolutely obvious. And then when people came back from their ski holiday and half term in February, it was absolutely clear that this was a massive thing going on. And, you know, the UK, which is where I primarily work when I'm not in West Africa, so it was always like 3 weeks behind the curve. So we could see it come across, but very quickly, because we had the genome sequence so quickly from the Chinese Institute, very quickly diagnostics were developed. And by February, we already had things set up in the public health laboratories, at least in some of them, where diagnostics were happening. And then, you know, people got, it was literally all hands on deck by this point, because I also still work in the NHS. So there were preparations for pandemic preparedness going on in the hospital. Places were getting rezoned, intensive care was getting ramped up. And so that all happened in like March then. And we were starting to see, you know, a real flurry of activities around getting studies together around therapies, but also the first vaccine ideas came up. And I remember sitting on lots of grant committees to look at what would really be the science that could drive this forward. Lots of money was on the table all of a sudden, which is not always the case in infectious diseases research.
We already start to get questions, but maybe we can clarify some general issues beforehand. How do you, sorry, I'm just reading questions meanwhile in the in the comment sections. So how do you researchers tackle this issue of vaccine development when you first meet fairly unknown virus or viral disease?
I guess, you know, you need to know what you're dealing with. I mean, the first thing was, it was only really that, you know, you get reports from people falling seriously ill in a place far away from you. So you need to figure out what is the cause of this illness. And then because of this happening in a, you know, a relatively well-resourced setting in China, people were very quick to identify this coronavirus. And because we'd seen coronaviruses before causing serious illnesses such as SARS and MERS, it became obvious that this was, you know, not to just be poo-pooed and be taken really seriously. And the mortality rates were really, really high. So this wasn't just flu or some, you know, cold or something. And it wasn't the same as SARS. It wasn't the same as MERS. But we had a leg up because we knew about the viruses that had caused SARS and MERS. And therefore, you know, people wanted to know where was the animal reservoir. And then the next thing is to see if it could be clamped down before it got out of hand.
Yeah, exactly. Can you tell us a little bit about vaccine research, how that works? Because now calling these words like phase one, phase three, are such a buzzword today, but without deeper understanding what these mean.
So it was obvious that, you know, for an expanding infectious disease, a vaccine would be needed. So the first thing you need is information about the target of what that vaccine should actually prevent. And in order to for vaccines to work, we have to mimic the natural infection without making people ill. So that means we have to use information from the virus to predict what would be important for the immune system to see, if you want, in some form of disguise, to make the right kind of immune response. And, you know, with the viruses, we knew that it would be a mixture of antibody and probably also T cells. So you look for what's called the epitopes or the antigenic determinants. So the thing that make the pathogen or the virus in this case, the infectious particle that can be a protein on the surface. And in the case of SARS-CoV-2, it is this funny spike protein that is sticking out when you're looking at the configuration. It's got these bits of stuff that stick out. So
that's where the name comes from, Corona.
That's right. It looks like a crown. And therefore, that's the bit of information that you need to present to the immune system to get a reaction from the immune system. So you try and integrate that information into whatever vaccine you make. So you can make a vaccine really in the design stage by thinking about, are you just going to kill off that virus and make it not infective anymore? And can you stick that into a vaccine? Are you going to use some of the protein that is sitting on the virus, some sugars? Or are you going to use, in fact, the genetic information of the virus and use that like a bit like in a Trojan horse scenario, stick it into something else that then presents it to the immune system? So these are all what's called preclinical decisions, and people sit and think about how would they design their vaccine. Then once they've got a construct that they think could work, it would have to go through animal experiments and cell cultures and trying to figure out whether actually this can be, you know, it's biochemistry that is required at the beginning. You have to put this into some sort of solution or so to get to a product. And so those are all the preclinical steps. And then once you've seen that this virus or this vaccine that you've created, it's essentially a chemical product, can induce an immune response, then you can inject it into animals to start with, usually. And you can see that, you know, there isn't some horrendous reaction in the animals, because you need to make sure that you come up with a product that's primarily, first of all, safe. And the next consideration is what dose would you have to give in order to figure out how much antibody or how much cell-mediated immunity is produced by this antigen. And then you can proceed to what we call human clinical trials, which start in a phase where you have very few healthy volunteers who might get different doses of this antigen. So these are usually people between 18 and 55 or so who are perfectly healthy, have had lots of blood tests before to make sure there isn't anything untowards. And then you inject, I mean, it's not like you're starting from scratch, right? So people have large experience with vaccines already. It's not like you and I making the vaccine and it's not the chemistry set we got for Christmas or something. You know, these are people who know how to make vaccines, right? So there is already some idea about what could be the right dose, and people will try, you know, what they think is the right dose, and then one potency above, one potency below, and they do what's called phase one is safety and dose finding. And then if that looks good, it goes into phase two, which is a slightly bigger group of people, let's say, you know, in the tens, maybe up to a couple of hundred or so, again, healthy, fit people. And there you gain more safety information, and you're starting to measure the immune response that you're inducing with this vaccine. And you're doing lots and lots of tests in the lab to make sure it actually looks like it is inducing the stuff that you want to see, what you think is important to fend off the infection. And only once you're there can you go into large groups of people where you're looking for safety and then eventually efficacy. And efficacy means that if you have had the vaccine, the chances of you getting the disease is much reduced. And when we see these sort of numbers that are coming out right now, like 90% efficacy, like it means like if you had given the vaccine to 100 people, only 10 of them would have gotten the disease. So 90% efficacy of a vaccine is a pretty good result. And then,
okay, great, but
you want to go further? No, let's stick there for now.
Yeah, as you said, these are so many steps with so many, many studies, which normally takes years and years of studies and development. How come we can develop a vaccine so fast nowadays with the COVID-19? Many people are very suspicious about this, saying that you cannot rush it because then it might not be as safe as it would be in the normal procedure.
Yeah, and I understand those concerns, because you say, okay, why can you do it so quickly this time and you can't do that normally? So what is different in this process?
And time pressure.
So I think what we need to think about is, first of all, we were already capitalizing on experience with the design for coronavirus vaccines through the SARS and MERS experience. So there were literally vaccines on the shelf that had already gotten to phase one. It didn't go any further that time because the disease kind of went away. So the bottom fell out of that investment, in a sense, because people couldn't be bothered. So that was revisited very, very quickly. And, you know, what made the main difference was the amount of money that was thrown on the table, to be honest, because what happens normally, you go through these phases of development, and every time you have to show the results, then you have to apply for more money, then you have to, you know, efficacy trials are hugely expensive. They cost millions.
But sorry to interrupt you here. Yeah. Who finances these? Because if I think of pharmaceutical companies, it might be not too profitable for them to develop a vaccine that might be used only once. So is it like a government or intergovernmental effort to put money on the table?
Yeah, I mean, I can primarily speak for the UK, but also for the US and some just a little bit for the European community. So in the UK, we have the Medical Research Council, we have the BRC, BBSRC, which are technology investments. And literally they stepped up. So there were competitions announced literally immediately, and they were for several million pounds. And people could make proposals. And then there was a committee who would decide who would be the best placed candidate to get the money. In the UK, the government put an enormous amount. I can't tell you the number now, but an enormous amount of money. In the US, it was probably about 10 times that money. There's a group called BARDA, which is in charge of developing, you know, interventions for emerging infections. The EU stepped up and put a huge pot of money aside. So it's really run by governments, except that there were also some companies that really wanted to be in the space. And for example, the vaccine that's been developed by Pfizer was entirely developed through Pfizer's own efforts. And basically, they decided to put the money where they wanted to be because it's very prestigious. And it's, you know, and it's potentially also very profitable, because if we end up with having to use the same vaccine every year or so, then amazing, right?
Yeah, right. But this also suggests that there are many, many, probably hundreds or thousands of research groups working on the vaccine, or at least parts of the vaccine development process. How can you even coordinate their work? Because there can be duplications, there can be redundancies in the system.
Oh, absolutely. Or... yeah. And, you know, there is redundancy and there is a lot of duplication. So, you know, we set up this vaccine tracker at my vaccine center in the London School, which you're welcome to look
at. I put the link in the description so you can find it.
Yeah. There. And we have over, you know, I think by now about 250 or so candidates in preclinical development. And that, you know, at the beginning, nobody had any idea whether any of what people were developing was actually any use. So a lot of investment went in also from universities to get to the point where products can be put into phase one. And I'm sure there will be a bottleneck now, because we will have all these candidates. People were talking about, well, the first generation is unlikely to work. Now we're in a bit of a different position, because it actually looks very promising even for the first generation, because the efficacy is much higher than we thought. And I think in the space where it was very open, people just wanted to give it a shot.
Talking about efficacy, Moni is asking a very good question here. How an efficacy trial is designed, briefly, presumably in human trials, there is no artificial infection, so how the efficacy can be studied? Yeah, it also raises ethical questions, whether you can infect people on purpose to check the efficacy of a vaccine, or how so does it work?
Sure. These are two slightly different things. One is a human challenge experiment, which we can talk about, because it's also been contemplated and there are initiatives going that way. But to understand an efficacy trial is you need to be in an environment where the disease is still pretty frequent. So, and this is the environment in which we found ourselves with COVID, right? So you give, let's say you, in your efficacy trial, you need to have a certain number of cases so that then you can split them into which one of these cases got the vaccine and which one got what's called the placebo. So that's the dummy vaccine. So you always have to have a control, because otherwise you can't tell, because people might not get the disease because whatever, they weren't on the bus with the COVID, right? So you, if you take 40,000 people, which is roughly what these sort of volumes are, and you give half of them the dummy vaccine and the other half the vaccine that you think will be protective, and then you watch them for a little while, like, you know, at the moment, I mean, these trials started in July and we're now not even 6 months into it. And all of a sudden you've ended up with nearly 200 cases. And then you look, and people are blinded. So the people who get the vaccines, or the participants, the volunteers, who are really the people who make this all happen, and we need to be grateful to them, they don't know if they had the dummy vaccine or if they had the real thing, because you don't want them to change their behavior. And the person who's given the injection also doesn't know if they've given the dummy vaccine or the real vaccine. So it is called double blind. And people are randomized by a lottery number that none of the investigators know, whether they're in the group that got the dummy vaccine or the real thing. And then you follow them up and then you see who gets the disease. And then when you have, let's say, 150 or 200 cases or so, you look at the numbers in terms of who got the vaccine, the real thing, and who got the dummy. And for example, with the Moderna vaccine or with the Pfizer vaccine announced yesterday, they had, I think, 170 cases altogether of the COVID infection. And only 8 of them had been in people who had gotten the real vaccine. And the other 162 were all in the people who hadn't been given the vaccine. And that makes it an efficacy calculation of about 95%. So that's pretty convincing. But you wouldn't want to do that, like, let's say you only have 10 cases. Could be by accident.
Yeah, right. I keep checking on the other screen. I opened up this vaccine tracker. I wanted to share the screen. Sorry for looking away for a second. I couldn't manage it at the moment. But I'm looking at this table where all the clinical trials are running. And when you said there are 40,000 people involved, and that's normal, it is absolutely. I can see there is one in Russia, for example, with 40,000 cases in phase three. There are Argentinian vaccines, 60,000 is included in USA, Argentina, and Brazil. So yes, there are many, many people. What is the minimum number that you can use here? When you can say that this is very safe, like,
yeah. So, you know, you will get, so there's a question of what's the minimum number to show efficacy, which slightly depends on how much disease is still around. So there isn't an absolute around, you know, there's not an absolute number because you need to have a credible amount of cases. You can roughly estimate and you can calculate that how many cases per month you would expect and then how many people you would, sample size calculations, and statisticians do these things. If you wanted to see, the question is how many people do you have the vaccine given to show it's safe? That's a different story. So there are, when you look at safety, you're looking at local side effects. So most of the people who are in this audience probably have had the odd vaccine. So you get a bit of a sore arm or you feel a bit fluey the next day or so. You know, that's one of the reasons why people don't particularly want to have injections. But, you know, it's a short-lived side effect and that's not a severe reaction. Whilst if someone has the injection and they get whatever, you know, as it happened with a couple of the candidates, they get some neurological condition 2 months later. That is a signal that you need to really carefully look if that could be related to the vaccine or if, in fact, it is a condition that people get in normal times even without being vaccinated. So that's where
That's why in the news we could hear that many trials were suspended for some time because of such reactions. So this actually means that the procedure is safe, right? Because many people interpret this that, oh, they had to suspend it. This must mean
not
that
at all. Not at all. That's exactly what they should do. And it's due diligence to investigate whether a reaction is related to something, you know, that happened to you by accident or because you, whatever, have a disposition to this disease anyway, or if it could have to do anything with the vaccine. And the important thing is those judgments are not made by the people who produce the vaccine. Those judgments are made by people who are an independent committee. And I think that's really important because otherwise you just think, oh, well, if it's a company, they might just, you know, push it under the carpet or so. So there are some very rigorous procedures around that. And, you know, no vaccine is any good unless it is, first of all, safe, effective. And the third point is it has to be licensed. And the people who have the final decision and say about the licensure, again, they're not the companies. The companies have to submit an enormous dossier to the regulators who file through every single side effect to, you know, seeing if it's appropriate or if any corners have been cut or, you know, there have been trial protocol violations, etc. So I think it's a fairly robust system. And given the fact that so many people were included in this, gives us confidence that we have a reasonable safety database. And it's roughly the same number that would have been included had we run the trials over 5-6 years. It's just because we needed results quickly. Lots and lots of sites have stepped up and literally people have dropped everything in order to focus on these trials rather than other things they were doing.
You probably met this view on the internet, everywhere, that if people can be reinfected, it also means that there is no immunization occurring, at least to some people, against this virus. So how can a vaccine be effective in this situation?
It's a really important question, and we don't yet have the definitive answers to that because the disease is quite new. I mean, we know that coronaviruses can infect us repeatedly, and there are four other types of coronaviruses that just cause a common cold, and everybody gets a cold once a winter or so. Our immune system isn't so particularly brilliant wired up to get on top of these kinds of infections, because normally they don't do an awful lot of harm, right? So there is a sort of selection pressure there from nature as well. So with SARS and MERS, they killed so many people that actually the disease died out. So that, from a virus point of view, that's very stupid because you take yourself out of the equation.
Yeah, we were talking about this much in detail in the first episode of this series.
All right. But so with the new coronavirus, we are only just in this, you know, if you imagine you had your infection, you usually mount an immune response. Let's say it's just ordinary antibody. So that antibody has a half-life of at least 3 months. And that means you're probably pretty safe for the following 6 months or so not to get it again. So if you think about it, the majority of people would have gotten their coronavirus infection sometime between January and the summer. Lots of them are not even in the second phase of exposure. So to know whether they get reinfected is very early. We have seen some reports of people who got reinfected, but they didn't get the disease as badly. I think there's the odd case report where a person got very sick. But if you think about the millions of people who've been infected with corona now, we haven't seen that there's lots and lots of people who are getting it again. So the immunity might be stronger than we think. Now, how does that compare? We don't know. How does it compare to vaccine immunity? We don't know. We haven't yet given these vaccines, right? So we will have to see how the immunity to the vaccine compares with the natural immunity. And antibody is only one part of the equation. It's probably not everything. So, yeah, it's too early to really say. We might need it every year.
There is a question that you might like, especially because it's in your field. Does the vaccination of the mother has immunizing effect on the baby?
Yeah, so this is a really hot topic that we're thinking about very, very carefully. So you're talking about the a pregnant woman receiving the vaccine, and there is a way that the antibody of the mother crosses the placenta. So the principle that by immunizing the mother, we can protect the baby definitely holds. No pregnant women have been included in the vaccine trials to date, and we don't have any safety database for pregnant women with this vaccine. We have large safety databases for other vaccines that have been given in pregnancy, for example, against tetanus or whooping cough or flu. And we know that the system works because the baby is then protected, and that's great. Whether the same is true, this the principle holds true for COVID-19 as well, but whether we are in a position where we should be giving the vaccines to pregnant women is something we're very, very carefully thinking right now. And, you know, I think we need to have a bit more ideas about the individual vaccine candidates that are coming through, because they're not all the same. You wouldn't want to give, you know, a live vaccine to a pregnant woman, and the mRNA vaccines have never been given to anyone before. So it might not be the vaccine we want to rush to, although there isn't really a good theoretical consternation why they shouldn't be safe in pregnant women. But, you know, we're not just worrying about the woman, we're also worrying about the unborn child and the newborn. So we're thinking about this very hard, and we'll be coming up with some recommendations very soon around this, actually.
I'm sure we will be much smarter in like 5 years or 10 years when we look back at this situation. But when do you think a vaccine, a useful vaccine, can be implemented in the public?
Yeah. So I think, you know, we're getting much closer, and it's faster than even I thought it was going to happen. So the first thing is the candidates that are looking good now. First of all, we were surprised by the efficacy data we're seeing. You know, there was a discussion around what would be an acceptable level of efficacy. And people, including the WHO, thought 50% would be pretty good. Now we're talking, you know, high 80s, 90%. So it's beyond expectations. And now we just need to go through the step of getting the licensure or the emergency approval. And then there is a logistics issue, and there is an issue with supplies, because nobody can make, you know, millions and millions of vaccine overnight. There aren't even enough glass vials in the world. There aren't even enough, you know, people who can give these vaccines. So there has to be a degree of prioritization. And I think, you know, we will be seeing the first vaccines coming through to people in our communities, prioritized, like the elderly, healthcare workers, care workers, et cetera, within the start of the new year. And then as the supplies get ramped up, and also, which is good that we have more than one vaccine because different companies can make different things, we can then dish it out more widely. But I think, you know, come the spring, we will have a better situation. But I don't think we'll have it under the Christmas tree. Let's put it like that.
Okay. Talking about prioritization, you were talking about who should get it first, like healthcare workers and elderly people and whoever is in need of this. But talking about priorities worldwide, how do you see the situation? Like, yeah, people in the States or in Europe are more likely to get it sooner than people in Africa or European countries.
You're making a very important point there. And there has been, over this period, one of the negative sort of feelings that I had about it, a degree of vaccine nationalism and a degree of sort of people being very possessive about the vaccine that was made with their funding in their country, etc. So as a consequence, and to anticipate the situation from arising, there is an international initiative that's called COVAX, which is part of the Access to Treatment Accelerator initiatives, which is global. And people sat around the table and they said, okay, and the people who are carrying this is WHO and CEPI, which is the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Initiative, which was very much born out of the Ebola situation. Because I think really with Ebola, it started to dawn on us that we would need to change the way in which we're doing business, so that we had to have vaccines not just stuck on the shelf for 10 years, nobody bothering, when there were lots and lots of people dying, although primarily in Africa. And there had to be more of an international solidarity effort. So there's CEPI, there's WHO, and there's Gavi, which is the main organization who actually makes vaccines available for low and middle income countries through what's called advanced market agreements. So these this coalition has raised a huge amount of funds from the international community to literally buy into the vaccine market. And our countries, including the EU and the UK, and, you know, of course, under Donald Trump, the US wasn't part of it, but now with Joe Biden, that will probably change. And China is part of it as well. They have supported this initiative as they are supporting supply of vaccines for low and middle income countries in general. And there's been like an almost like an exchange of goods. So if people paid into the pot, they're also paid into an advanced access for the vaccines that they might need for their countries. So a bit of a tit for tat that can then support the countries that might not be able to afford. So the question is, of course, does everybody really need the vaccine? And, you know, the goal of CEPI at the moment, of COVAX at the moment, is to have 20 billion, is it 20? Yeah, I think 20 billion doses. Is it, hang on, is it 2 or 20? Sorry, I'm confused now. But a certain a lot, vaccines ready by 2021. I think it's 2 billion doses by the end of 2021, because they went ahead and they did a mapping exercise of the facilities in the world that can actually produce vaccines, because many countries don't have their own vaccine production. And they reckoned that there could be 2 billion doses by the end of 2021. And those should be distributed equally to the 20% most needy people in any country that COVID was an issue. And that's a very equitable way of going around the vaccine supply. Whether that will hold true, we will have to see, because obviously, you know, if Pfizer can produce whatever, 200 million doses for the US, I'm sure there'll be a bit of a bun fight whether they should be going to COVAX or they should be going to the US people now. So we will see. But there is a really important international initiative not to have just the vaccine nationalism prioritize countries. Except, you know, the epidemic hasn't been quite as bad in Africa as we anticipated. But that doesn't mean, you know, we live in a global world. And as we've seen with this virus, it can come back anytime from any part in the world.
Exactly. And this is what Attila's question might be related to. How fast does the coronavirus mutate? Is it a big chance to every year to come a new mutation like a flu, or can we erase it like retroviruses?
Yeah. So I'm not a virologist, but from what I understand is that there have already been the odd mutation. For example, you might have heard about this scenario with the minx in Denmark. So there is a mutation, but the vaccines that are currently being designed still cover that fully. And I think, you know, it will not be like flu. I think we can be pretty certain it's not going to be like flu, but we'll probably have to adapt. And it's very important. It's very important that we keep sequencing these isolates. And you know, one of the good things about the this sort of what's called the plug and play technology with the RNA is that potentially we can recreate a similar vaccine with a slight alteration of the antigenic properties quite easily. And because there will be all this experience, then it will be quite quick to produce that as well. So the antigenic drift isn't something that I'm particularly concerned about at this point in time.
But are you concerned about?
What am I concerned about? I'm concerned about, the logistics of getting vaccines out to, you know, reasonable quantities of people wherever they are. I mean, to, you know, someone asked whether I could come onto a program in Scotland and just help them discuss how they get the vaccine to the Western Isles. And I said, no, that wasn't my job because, you know, the very remote areas, it will be a challenge to get vaccines there. And, you know, not every candidate is likely to be equally easily to roll out. So, you know, the Pfizer vaccine needs a significant amount of cold chain, much more so in temperatures of minus 70. The Moderna vaccine needs minus 20. So, you know, to think about that as an option for Africa is really hard because we can barely sustain normal fridges between 2 and 4 degrees in those circumstances. So that might not be the first choice of vaccine you want to use in those places. And you know, that might automatically decide which vaccines go to what countries. And you know, it's also the costs and stuff. So the equity of access, I think, is a big concern for me. The other thing is the sort of pecking order in which we're dishing the vaccines out, and whether there'll be, you know, a bun fight. Society will say, well, this is outrageous, and maybe the English football team should have it so we can all go back to the sports places, or should be made mandatory, or it should be, you know, we can't possibly give it to pregnant women, or, you know, the vaccine hesitant people saying, well, we don't want to be vaccinated at all. So there are, you know...
We will get to vaccine hesitant, or as you put it very nicely, anti-vaxxers in a bit. But there is another question here. What conditions do a person has to meet in order to be a candidate who they are testing the vaccine on? Maybe Nif Dalan wants to be one of these fortunate ones who might get the
exactly. Best easier. So the question is, how can you become a volunteer for a vaccine trial? So, you know, there are very, in the protocols, again, when you look at the vaccine tracker, you can see the protocols for all of these trials. They are publicly available. And you can see which age group is included. And it's usually men and women. It's usually, especially at the moment, across ethnicity. And it's pretty much also across age groups, because we need to show that the vaccine works in all age groups, and particularly in the elderly people. And often we don't have as responsive an immune system in elderly people. So this was a very important part of data to get. So the trials are done in collaboration, usually with universities, hospitals, or clinical trial sites, sometimes companies as well. And there's a campaign that usually tells you, okay, there's a trial going on in my neighborhood or where have you. And then you get information about that. And then you go for pre-screening, and they will take a blood sample, and they'll see if you meet the inclusion criteria and if you don't meet any of the exclusion criteria, which are specified in the protocol. So the first thing is to find out if there are any trials going on where you live. And the second thing is to contact these investigators and see if they need more people. And then to see if you fit the criteria. This is easy as that.
Talking about anti-vaxxers, or how do you call them? Vaccine?
I think there's a difference. I actually make a differentiation between anti-vaxxers and hesitant people. So we can talk about that a bit, yeah.
Okay. According to a recent study here in Hungary, very low number or percentage of people are willing to get the vaccine once it's done. I'm not sure if it's because there was a very bad reputation of the Russian vaccine that seems to be readily available soon, or there might be some other aspects to it. I'm not sure about the details, but how do you tackle this problem as a vaccine scientist?
So the first, I mean, you know, vaccine. So first of all, let me define a little bit what I mean by anti-vaxxers and vaccine hesitant people. So the whole thing is about vaccine confidence. How confident are you that the vaccine you're going to get or you want to take is going to protect you for a start? And how confident are you that there are not going to be any side effects that you might, you know, of course, want to avoid? Everybody wants to avoid them. But also, how confident are you in the system that is going to give you the vaccine? And I think that's more and more important, especially also in the Eastern European countries. So I would call anti-vaxxers the people who are quite militant about this, who would just say they'll never vaccinate their children and they'll all go through life without vaccines, etc. That's quite an extreme position. But there are lots of people who I would call vaccine hesitant. And they just
I just added a very quick comment. Of course, it was just joking that don't forget the chips in the Russian vaccines.
Yes. Well, this is about the system, right? That's precisely what I was saying. So the system in which your vaccination might happen and the trust in your healthcare system and the politics that might be related to that. So, but people who are vaccine hesitant might be people who are asking very good questions. You know, there are people who want to know more, who want to dig a bit deeper to make an informed choice. And that's not a wrong thing to do. Nobody has to like blindly take a product. We are all grown up people. We're all entitled to ask for what is in a vaccine, how is it being tested, why is this the right thing for me to do? And you know, as a pediatrician, I have those discussions with parents all the time. And I'm glad they ask, because I'd rather they ask and give me a chance to explain rather than saying, you know, shutting the door, saying they'll never do it. So that's what I call, they're vaccine confident people who are people who will just trust. Then there are people who are vaccine hesitant who need good arguments and convincing, hopefully. And then there are the extreme anti-vaxxers. And I think we have a really hard time to convince those people, because I think they have a number of other issues that don't just relate to vaccines.
What is your level of confidence? Will you get vaccinated as soon as the first vaccine appears?
Yeah, especially now that I've seen the safety data. And I mean, you know, obviously I wouldn't get vaccinated with an unlicensed vaccine unless I was a volunteer in the trial. But as a healthcare professional, I would get in the queue as quickly as I can, because I want to protect myself, my family, and also I want to not give an infection to anyone I look after in hospital, for example. I got my flu vaccine the day it came out.
That was very encouraging. Thank you. I just heard that you will travel to Africa, just to change the topic slightly, very soon. Can you tell us a few words about that project that you're working on over there?
Yeah. So I work in, you know, global vaccines and global child health in general. And I run a vaccine research at a place in West Africa called the Gambia. And it is an institution that was initially set up by the British government. It was called the Medical Research Council Unit in the Gambia. And it now also belongs to the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. And it is a great institution. It's been there for over 70 years. It employs over 1,000 people. And amongst other things, research into malaria, tuberculosis, all sorts of things. We do a lot of studies on vaccines, because in West Africa, the mortality from infectious diseases that can be prevented by vaccines is still very high. And the vaccines have had a massive impact there against pneumonia, against meningitis. And there's still more work to be done. And, you know, that's where, for example, do the studies of vaccines for pregnant women, for example, as well. So, I go there every other month and I lead a large team of over 200 people there. And it's, you know, a very interesting contrast to what we see in well-resourced healthcare systems like our own in the UK or in Germany, where I'm from originally. So we haven't, and obviously we were really, really concerned about the impact of COVID in Africa because of the high mortality figures and very sick people we were seeing in the West. And yet it hasn't been as bad as we anticipated. And people have generally dealt with this disease very differently. And it's very interesting to figure out what actually led to, you know, there not being the gloom and doom scenario in Africa. However, Africa has suffered what I would call COVID collateral, because a lot of funding was pulled for interventions that are also necessary. I mean, routine immunizations, maternal and child health, TB control, malaria, all of that. And we need to make sure that that goes back to where it actually belongs, and without neglecting certain threats from COVID still as well.
Well, there are still a lot to do in these areas. Thank you very much for being here tonight and sharing all this information with us.
Sure.
And answering all the questions. This was COVID Conversations for tonight. Next week, we will reach the last episode of this mini-series. That will be on a completely different aspect of the pandemics on disinformation. Guests will be, I might not say his name right, Alexander Herasimenko, researcher at the Oxford Internet Institute Computational Propaganda Team, and Peter Krekus, social psychologist, political scientist from Hungary, from Political Capital. Feel free to join us next Thursday at 7 p.m. Central European Time. I'd like to say thank you to British Council, especially to Edina Torian for helping a lot with organizing these online events, and also to the Embassy of the United Kingdom here in Budapest for making COVID Conversations possible. And of course, thank you for your attention. Have a nice evening. Goodbye.